Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallahassee.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much. One more time, Audrey, how do you do it? Year after year after year, week after week, you get us connected and you get our show organized and set. It's just incredible. And one of these days, you'll be on the Radio Hall of Fame, I'm sure. All right, Audrey, thank you very much. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show tonight. Tonight we're going to be talking about, we will not be talking about President Trump and former director of the FBI, James Comey. Is that okay? I think they broke the record, the news channels here in the last 3 days on that particular subject. But anyway, let's don't do that. Its Twitter account is, what, broken down from all this coverage of those two things? Okay, I'll shut up, Audrey. I'm right. Okay, but once again, we thank you very much for joining us on the show. And tonight we are going to be talking about crime. Imagine that. On the Keith Haley Show, we're going to be talking about crime. And we are going to be talking about something that worked. And now the professor that wrote the book says we're paying a price for it. I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut on this because, you know, I have followed crime since about the early 1960s. Yes, that long, from the streets of being a cop to professor to heads of criminal justice programs to all kinds of other things that at least put food on the table. All right, and I have written quite a bit about this subject of crime, and some of you actually know that. All right, here we go. But our show is dedicated to those tireless, energetic, professional, and heroic police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. What would we be doing without them? And you know, people are finally coming back to that idea. You know, these cops are pretty important people because, you know, when my son overdoses with heroin, they show up and give him his Nalcocone or whatever that junk is called. There's no subject I know less about than drugs, but I do know that I'll have some news stories tonight about how serious, more than serious, that has become. It's in the category of a true tragedy, and we need to do something about it, and we should not be, don't get me started on that. Okay, anyway, that's what we're going to be doing tonight. We're going to be talking about some things that came in when crime rates were extremely high, and in the last 4 or 5 years, you've had the lowest crime rates we've had in three decades, four decades, that type of business, and we did some things right. The professor here, he will, James Foreman, he'll be talking about his book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America, in which he examines criminal justice policies placed in operation in the early 1970s and 80s to curb rising crime. And nobody knows better how it worked than New York City. Rudy Giuliani, he knew how to do it when he came in the early 1990s. Ray Kelly, police chief, Bratton, police chief. I mean, these people knew what to do. Now, did it have some negative consequences? You tell me what we do about spiraling crime rates now. Look at Chicago. Look at Baltimore's asking for help. They don't know what to do. The city of Baltimore, the crime, that's unbelievable. And then I'll have news stories about the narcotics and all that business, but gee, May Christmas is just incredible. It's what has happened here in the recent times. Anyway, we're going to do something about it. America always wins out in the end, and I think we'll continue to do that and set the policy for perhaps some of the parts of the world. Okay, let's go ahead and take a look at some of the news stories in here tonight and get that, not get it over with, but talk to you about some of these news stories. here's one that's kind of interesting. I didn't talk about this 2 weeks ago, did I, Audrey? No. Here's the pit bull. Dayton, Ohio, police are still looking for the identity and locate the owner of a pit bull that mauled a man to death. A man was 60 years old. His name was Maurice Brown, who was walking in the neighborhood. And this little creature comes out. They're not little, but comes out and ends up killing this man. The property owner is in a nursing home, and it's not clear who lives there. The dog owner could face charges. No kidding. The dog owner could face charges. But when those things became popular, and having been a beat cop, you take probably three or four dog bite complaints a week, and all these people always tell you, you know, he doesn't bite, she doesn't bite people. No, she or he don't bite them, but they bite everybody else that's walking down the sidewalk or crossing the street or whatever. Here's murder in Baltimore. Baltimore's mayor now is asking for help from the FBI as the city struggles to contain a soaring murder rate. Can you believe it? They're at a 20-year high. It's reached a crisis level with a number of killings shattering a 20-year high this year. And of course, they're not up with Chicago yet. But can you believe what happened there last? Don't even get me started, Audrey. I don't want to talk about it. If you're going to Chicago, drive around it. Check out Crime Spot and hit the crime rates and violence in Chicago. You will not believe it. You ever heard of a guy named Mayor Emanuel? He was chief of staff for President Obama. Where is he? I hear other people, I don't hear the mayor, and I don't see many articles on the news, first headlines, or any place like that where he's even talking about anything. But isn't that incredible? She said she met with special agents in charge of the Baltimore Division of the FBI, and I'm sure how much they're going to be doing about crime, but wouldn't provide specifics. She says that she'll come out next week, and the FBI isn't talking. I said I wasn't going to mention the FBI, but I guess I did. Unbelievable. They're talking about using the FBI. They have field offices, 56 field offices nationwide. The FBI, remember Governor Brown in California, who said, I'm not going to put people in the counterterrorism task force because the FBI doesn't do anything. They sit in the office. Well, that's not entirely true, but they do have other functions. They do. Let's leave local policing to local policing is the way I look at it. Okay, here we go. Ohio executions. Execution dates for the 9 death row inmates have been delayed while the state continues its appeal of a court decision blocking use of a lethal injection protocol. So we can't figure out how to, this is a May 1 story, so it's a couple weeks old, but Governor Kasich, you know, 9 executions were pushed back by the governor, and they're going to wait and see, and they got a whole list of guys. One of these guys killed kids. Unbelievable. Is that the one? I'm not going to talk about that one. It'll probably be a story next week. Speeding. Have you noticed people picking up in speed? They say, I haven't got any data on this, but the Dayton police chief say they want their speed cameras back and their red light cameras. People are just blowing these lights. Have you noticed anybody texting and talking on the phone while they're driving? It's insane now. These people are driving 6 inches off your tail bumper. They're running into all kinds of people, and these cameras would help do something about that. The number one cause of traffic death is what? A short clear distance, and half of those are speeding probably because they were too close and they couldn't stop. But we need to do something about this. Can you imagine losing family members? Well, I know people, I knew people who died this way, and it's just incredible. We did have a man in the Arlington, Texas sports bar save the lives of people because he was a concealed carry, legal concealed carry holder. And two people died Wednesday night at a popular sports bar in Arlington, Texas, including a suspected gunman who police said was shot to death by the armed customer. Isn't that great? I love it. I mean, that is I wish it never happened, but as long as this guy pulls out his gun, he carries it legally, and he saved these people's lives. So the customer who had a handgun saw the shooting and fired his weapon, striking the suspect. The suspect was pronounced dead at the scene, according to police. Okay, that's a good thing to do. What do these people do when they go to prison? Do you know? These criminals, these violent criminals, these career burglars, the dope dealers, it's on and on and on. I'll be on that in just a minute here in a news story. But prosecutors said a federal inmate in Atlanta and his fiance ran an inmate taxi service taking inmates around town to restaurants and hotels and returning them to prison in exchange for money. I'm not kidding. This is a story dated May 4. Prosecutors say 41-year-old Deldrick Jackson and 38-year-old Kelly Bass faced charges related to helping the inmates escape. So they would escape, they'd take them around town and then do their, I shouldn't use the term Uber, but use their cab service, inmate cab service to bring them back to the cab. And keep in mind, they're out of the prison illegally. I mean, illegally, they're not allowed to be out of the prison. They were taken to places and often returned to prison with contraband without guards. I prefer the term corrections officers, without the guards even knowing that they left the prison. Is there something wrong there going on in that United States penitentiary? The prosecutors say Bass received about $4,000 from inmates, families, or accounts as they drove these people around in Atlanta. Can you believe that? By the way, we're behind. We have a buildup of more than 1.2 million illegal immigrants who it believes have overstayed their visas but managed to arrest only about 3,400 of them. We're off a little bit, 1.2 million. We've got 3,400, according to the most recent data. I don't even want to get into this, Audrey. Do you? We've talked about this so long. How long are we going to put up with this stuff? The amnesty stuff. Oh, don't even get me started. Police and sheriff's departments in Texas are decrying an immigration bill passed by the state legislature, saying it will drive a wedge between law enforcement and immigrant communities. The bill in question, this is Senate Bill 4, passed the Texas House Wednesday, and Governor Greg Abbott is expected to sign it. It includes provision that would ban sanctuary cities in the state and force officers to ask the immigration status of every individual they detain. And some of these police chiefs around the state, the two largest at Houston, they don't want to do that. They don't want to ask them their immigration status or be forced to ask them that. Now, can we figure out what the good reason for that is? James McLaughlin, executive director of the Texas Police Chiefs Association, complained to NBC about the punitive measures police could face under Senate Bill 4, fines, jail time, civil penalties, and the prospect of removal from office. Let's not hang around asking people who jaywalk and decide who may be here legally. Instead, let's go to work. Well, well, jaywalkers sometimes are criminals too. Okay, here's stuff that's unbelievable. Oh my gosh, unbelievable. Heroin sales. Boom. On a drizzly Monday afternoon, a man in a gray sweatpants and black Bengals hood sold a half gram of heroin for $70 inside a dingy market on the west side of Cincinnati. The buyer was a plainclothes cop, and the Cincinnati police say they're just overwhelmed with this now. The heroin traffic, heroin has become so pervasive in cities such as Cincinnati and so profitable for the cartels that supply it that even cops admit the sporadic arrests they have made have little effect. So we can't even do anything about it, they're saying, in Cincinnati about this. Isn't this incredible? Unbelievable. Let me give you a couple others. I'll finish on this one. Drug driving. This is now in Ohio. Drugged driving surpasses drunk driving fatalities. A new Governor's Highway Safety Association report shows drugged driving has now surpassed drunken driving as a factor in fatal crashes. Stats show that drugs were present in 43% of drivers in crash fatalities. Can you believe that? When are we going to do something about this? 43%. 3 out of 4 motorists surveyed say the use of illegal drugs before driving was a very serious threat, compared to only 66% who worried more about drunk driving. And, you know, just look at the highway. Look at them. They're left to center. They're in there. They're right up over the ditch. I mean, they're driving crazy. They blow stop signs. I've never seen anything like it. And we need to get busy on this one. Anyway, that's it for our news tonight. We do have a blonde joke for tonight, though, don't we? Yeah, we do. It's the joke is actually this. How do you confuse a blonde? And the answer is, guess what? That's impossible because they were born confused. Okay, I like that one. That's blonde men, by the way, not women. Okay, I hope you get that right. All right, here's a green tip, a good one from Germany. We're trying to save the planet. Let me take the temperature right now, Audrey. What is it? Yeah, it's going up 2 degrees since our show started. Must be my candles on my desk. Okay, a Berlin brothel comes up with an innovative way to attract customers during the economic crisis and do something to help avoid climate change at the same time. They're offering a discount. They're offering a discount to patrons who arrive on bicycles. So if you go to this brothel on a bicycle and lock it up outside on the bike rack, you're going to get, it looks like, what does it say, 3 pound discount. How about that? Isn't that, man, that is really great. That's great. And of course, we're going to have what? A cooler climate as a result of that. Oh my gosh, what a way to save the planet. Okay, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms would like you to hear, they don't want to hear it in Texas, but they'd like you to hear this little tip.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Yes, and I will amend Ohio Coalition that it's often deadly for the criminals who carry guns and attack people. We had an example of that tonight with our Texas story. So anyway, that's it for tonight. Now we're going to listen to a very informed gentleman, Professor James Forman, and he's going to talk about his book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And I'm going to let him tell the whole story. I may interrupt several places because he doesn't have all the facts There are other sources you can look at, and I might mention some of those. But anyway, let's go ahead and get set up, and we'll listen to him. Hold on a second.
Online at booktv.org. And now on BookTV, Yale Law School professor James Forman shares his conclusions on minority incarceration in America's prison system.
Oh, my gosh, he's a law professor. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
His book is called Locking Up Our Own.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I want to thank Politics and Prose and Busboys and Poets for hosting this event. There's obviously too many people here who I love and have known for a long time to shout out everybody individually, but I do want to shout out a couple of families. I want to shout out my PDF family who... Thank you. Y'all taught me how to be a lawyer. I want to shout out my See Forever Maya Angelou family and David Domenici in particular. Y'all taught me how to fight for children. And I want to give a shout to my SNCC family. I'm wearing my SNCC button tonight. As a public defender, thinking of the work that I was doing as the civil rights work of my generation, I was in court. I had joined PDS because I knew that 1 in 3 young black men was under criminal justice supervision. I knew, even though we didn't have the term mass incarceration yet, I knew that the United States had just passed Russia and South Africa as the world's largest jailer. So I'm in court, and I'm asking the judge to give Brandon a second chance, to put him on probation. I have letters from his counselors, from teachers, from social workers. Brandon's mom and his grandmother were in court there, and I pointed to them. The prosecutor in the case, African-American, was asking for Brandon to be locked up, to be sent to Oak Hill. Those of y'all that have been in D.C. for a while, you know the dungeon that was Oak Hill. The judge in the case ultimately had to make the decision, Judge Walker.
This is a very informed man, and I'm sure his book is worthy of reading, but I want to say one time. After all the study for the last 50 years and what we do about crime, ladies and gentlemen, guess what? We know that if someone is behind bars, they can't rape someone else, they can't rob them, they can't mug them, they can't burglarize their home. Yes, does it cost more money to keep them locked up than let them out? No, that is absolutely patently false. A good burglar gets caught maybe once every 200 times, something like that. Robbers can, on and on and on. So we're going to listen to the professor, and I won't interrupt him anymore. But let's be sure about what lowered the crime rates in cities like New York City and Los Angeles, etc.
I changed the names of the lawyers and the judges in the cases. Judge Walker leaned back, and then he looked forward at Brandon. Judge Walker was an African-American judge, and he said, Brandon, Mr. Forman has been telling me that you've had a hard life and that you deserve a second chance. Well, I don't doubt that you've had a hard life, son, but let me tell you what hardship was like. Let me tell you about Jim Crow. Let me tell you about segregation. Let me tell you about a movement that fought for your freedom. People marched, struggled, died. Martin Luther King died for you to be free. And what he did not die for was for you to be running and gunning and thugging and embarrassing your community and embarrassing your family. So you might get that second chance one day, young man, but right now you're going to go to Oak Hill. And ever since that day in court and many days like them, as I came to see that people like Judge Walker were not unique. There were many of them. It caused me to stop and ask the question, How was it that this African-American community came to lock up so many of its own? And that's what I set about to answer in this book. Now, the answer to the question is in the book. I hope you buy it. I'll sign it. But I know y'all not going to let me out of here until I at least give you like a preview. So let me tell you some of the main arguments of the book. The first thing we have to understand is crime and addiction and violence and the toll that it took on this community still takes, but especially in the 1960s and again in the 1980s. In the 1960s, Washington, D.C.'s homicide rate tripled. And it wasn't just D.C. It doubled in Philadelphia, in Cleveland, in Los Angeles. In D.C. in 1967, they tested all people entering the D.C. jail for drugs in their system. In 67, 3% of the entering inmates in the D.C. jail tested positive for heroin. 1 year later, in 1968, it was 45%. That's an epidemic. And it's not just the numbers. It's also the stories. When I went over to George Washington Library has archives of many of the former city council members here in D.C. They've donated their papers, and they're not super well organized, but they're well organized enough that you can get a sense. And I spent a whole summer reading through page after page, and the pain and suffering from the citizen letters is palpable. People are writing saying, I don't recognize my city anymore. I'm scared to go outside. I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I feel like a stranger on my own streets. Now, who was receiving these letters? And this gets to the second argument of the book. The people who were getting these letters, the first generation of elected officials and prosecutors and judges and court officials, in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s and in black communities around the country, that first generation of officials, many of them came out of the civil rights movement. My book is filled with ex-civil rights workers. And whether they came out of the movement or not, they were well aware of a history of under-enforcement of the law in black communities. They knew of the times when you didn't call the police. Because the police were probably the Klan. They weren't going to come, and if they did, they were going to do worse than if they didn't. Oh. They knew of a time when a black person died, law enforcement said, that's just one more dead black person, and they didn't say black person. They knew of that history, and they were bound and determined as they came into office in the 1970s to make black life matter. They didn't use the phrase then, but that's what they were doing. Chapter 2 of my book is called Black Lives Matter because their life's work of this first generation of officials was to make black life expensive, to make it valuable. Now,
I have to respond to that. I worked in a large city in the 1960s as a beat police officer, and never did we fail to respond to the calls and injuries and needs of black citizens.
Why did they do it through law enforcement? Why did they do it through police and prosecutors and prison? And this gets to the next argument of the book, which is an argument about the constraints and the limitations that they were under. So I told you this is a story about what African Americans thought and said and did, right, about black agency. But any story about African-American agency is also a story of constraints. It's also a story of limitations. It's also a story of a larger society which limited their options. So they were constrained in all kinds of ways. They were constrained by a history of racism that had produced residential segregation and had reduced entrenched crime patterns. They were also constrained by the fact that the larger society didn't want to do everything that they were asking for. So the people that I write about, these mayors, these city council people, these judges and prosecutors, many of them didn't want only law enforcement. They wanted job training. They wanted more money for education. They wanted more money for housing. They wanted an industrial plan for the cities. They wanted, many of them said, a Marshall Plan for urban America. But they couldn't get that because African Americans, with the power that we had, was concentrated locally. It was concentrated in cities. And the black community didn't control Congress, didn't control those levers of power. So I say that African American officials had an all-of-the-above strategy to try to fight crime and violence and addiction. They wanted to throw everything at the problem: police, prosecutors, courts, jobs, housing, schools, parks and recs. They wanted all of the above, but they got from the larger society one of the above. They got law enforcement. Now, you might be wondering, and I think it's natural as we sit here in 2017 to think, but they must have known what they were doing. They must have understood the consequences of doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on law enforcement. But a big argument in my book is that in many ways they didn't. Because there was no moment where there was an up or down vote on mass incarceration. That's not how it was built. Nobody ever said, hey, should the United States have the largest prison population in the world? Should we lock up more people in apartheid South Africa? No one asked that question. Instead, what happened was lots of people acting in different spaces in the system. Police officers arresting, prosecutors prosecuting, legislators passing laws, judges imposing sentences, parole officers making parole decisions, probation officers supervising people on parole. All of those actors all became somewhat more punitive. Everybody got harsher in their space, maybe 10% harsher, maybe 20% harsher. Maybe the sentences they imposed got a little longer. Maybe they revoked parole a little more often. But the thing is, if everybody does it, and everyone does it over 40 or 50 years, then the result is mass incarceration. The last thing I'm going to say before we turn it over to questions is mostly this book is about how we got here. There's one chapter about what to do about it and how to get out. And the one thing about that I want to say tonight is that we're going to have to get out, we're going to have to dismantle this system the same way that it was built, which is to say everyone, all of us, in small ways, pushing in the other direction. So the next time somebody says to you, well, that solution, will that proposal, will that legislation, will that solve mass incarceration? Say, no, it won't. That by itself won't. But that plus that plus that plus that plus that over time will. We have to recapture a certain amount of humanity. And that's going to mean in the public sector, but it's also going to mean in the private sector. Each of us has to ask, what's our sphere of influence? What do we control? Do we run a business that has an HR policy? And what does that HR policy say about hiring people that have criminal convictions? Do we run a university that has admissions policies? What do those look like for people that have been involved in the criminal justice system? Are we part of a church community? Have we adopted somebody, a returning citizen who's come to our community and helped through our church, help them find housing, help them find a job? We're going to have to do it through law, and we're going to have to do it through these private spaces. But if we do it slowly, we will dismantle this massive and unjust system. Thank you.
Sorry,
I'm
exactly on stage right now.
Let's
keep your hand raised. I'm trying to get everyone.
BDS is not allowed to ask questions. I'm just saying that now.
My question is, given that the president is currently working in Superior Court, given that Jeff Sessions is currently arbitrating and that the criminal cases in the District of Columbia are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney from having state prosecutors, the judge has a left hand to serve the court of the U.S. Attorney. He's already employed that court in terms of, you know, encouraging and arbitrating.
So thank you for that. So I want to think about the kind of Jeff Sessions question in two ways. So one really is more nationally. And I apologize for responding to your question about that term, but the book talk in the round. So, you know, what nationally people are asking this question. They're saying, you know, what can we do now that we have this administration that seems that has values and policies that are so counter to some of the incremental progress that was being made in the last administration? And, you know, to that, my main response, which isn't going to be an answer to your question, is more of an answer to kind of a national audience, is that it's really, this problem is fundamentally a state, county, city, and local problem, right? So 88% of prisoners nationwide are in state facilities, not federal ones. 85% of law enforcement officers nationwide are city, county, local law enforcement officers, not federal ones. So just like President Obama and Attorney General Holder got all the publicity in the last administration around criminal justice reform, but actually had a relatively small slice of the problem that they could affect, it's also true that Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions have, with all of their sort of retrograde policies that they're proposing, Sessions in particular, have a relatively limited ability to do damage. And that if the movement that we have built up at the state and local level nationally, that movement shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this system was built at the state and local level and it's going to have to be dismantled there. So I'm always, and this comes up a lot, you know, I'm spending the year out in California, and a lot of Californians, especially in the Bay Area, whenever a...
I have to comment on this. Do you think he's ever going to mention victims? Let's see.
Social justice issue comes up. They always say, well, you know, that's an important issue. If I lived in like a red state, if I lived in a Trump state, then maybe I would kind of need to work on that. But I live in liberal California, or I live in liberal New York. And what I want to say on criminal justice and mass incarceration is there is no liberal bubble. California has the second largest prison system in the country. New York, until recently, was one of only two states in the country to prosecute all juveniles aged 16 and 17 as adults. So there, this is a national crisis. It's a crisis in every nook and cranny of our country. So we need to know our local legislators. We need to know the people in our state house. We need to know our local prosecutor. Now, okay, that's all well and good nationally, but in D.C., it remains the case that through this unique and problematic system of the prosecutor reporting to the president, what that means is that you do have this crisis. So there I would say it's a little bit what I was talking about earlier about everybody operating in their sphere of influence. So one of the things that I noticed when writing this book is just like nobody said we want to be the world's biggest jailer, especially nobody said that in African-American communities. I mean, I can't find a single example
of people saying anything along those lines. But what's also true is there is a, this is going to be kind of a harsh version of the statement, but I'll just put it this way. There's a sort of a pass the buck kind of attitude. There's a lot of people when confronted with the unjust system that say, like when I interviewed prosecutors about this book, they would often talk about the police. And the problem is that the police bring us these cases, and if the police would bring us a different set of cases, then we would prosecute a different set of cases. And then when I interviewed judges, they said, well, see, the thing is, the problem is the prosecutors, because the prosecutors prosecute these certain type of cases. And what I want to say is, yeah, that somebody else, how someone else is working or not working is always a problem. But what can you control? And as a judge, you have a lot of power. And if you don't like the way things are going.
Does Professor Foreman realize that a lot of people don't want to work? If I'm a good burger, I'm not working 15 hours a day. It's maybe an hour and a half a night.
Certainly under D.C.'s sentencing system, you have a lot of authority to buck that. And that's true for everybody else in the system. So I guess what I want to say is it's going to be bad. The question then, though, is what can everybody else do in their sphere of influence to mitigate that harshness? And I think it's more than we sometimes assume.
You made mention.
Thank you.
You have made mention of the
try to ask, well, what is the opposite? And then my recommendation would be to do that. So we have, you know, in one of the things that I write about in the book, I'll run down a long list. I'll be real specific. That's exactly the problem. But it isn't one thing. That's exactly the thing. It's everything. And I completely agree with you. I don't want to wait for everybody. I want everybody in the space that they operate to look at where they control. So if you're a police officer or a police department and ask yourself, do we do pretext stops in this community? Do we stop people on the basis of a minor traffic infraction with the stated and sole goal of getting access to that car and searching that car? Not because we're doing traffic enforcement, but because we want to search the car. And if we're doing that, we know that that type of policing produces most of the racial disparity that we have as in policing. And we,
as a lawyer, you should know that you can't do a complete search of that car unless the proof level goes up beyond suspicion.
You want to stop that. If you're an employer, one of the people that I write about in the book is a woman named Sandra Dozier. She's stopped under pretext policing. Her car is searched. They find $20 worth of marijuana. The prosecutor's office, relatively progressive, no papers the case. They don't prosecute her. She's a probationary employee at FedEx. Before the end of her probationary status, she has to come in with a certificate of clean record. The random lottery of the D.C. Superior Court and the Metropolitan Police Department record searches sometimes, as PDS lawyers know, miss really big things, and sometimes really small things pop up on the computer. And in her case, the arrest for possession of marijuana popped up. She had turned it in. She thought because it was no paper that it was going to be okay, and she lost her job. That employer and employers like it could stop having practices that say we're going not going to hire you if you have an arrest for marijuana possession or many other crimes. So I could go down the list, and what I'm saying is, to respond to your question, we would have to go down the list and look at every single aspect of our system and ask, how can we make it more humane? How can we make it less harsh?
It's not very good at all. I apologize for that. Taking questions, not introducing speakers, but we'll see what happens.
The law. And if you're found guilty, he follows the law in citizenship. And if he has discretion, he will go with that. But the prosecutor is the one that pays the service, how much time you get, whether you get prosecuted, or anything. And it makes me frustrated if you can stand up there and talk with such eloquence. But you have no insight about really the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
I've been arrested by the police. I know how they treat you, and all police are not bad. And I've been arrested by the police 15 times.
didn't do it because I was just black. They didn't do it just because I was in the wrong neighborhood. But sometimes they stopped me. I was guilty. They didn't know that. But one thing I do know about this year, it's okay to speak from an outside point of view into the interview and write the book.
I am
the book that you're talking about.
I'd like, one of the arguments that I make is that we have not raised up the voices of people who have been incarcerated. We have not raised up voices like yours. We have taken people who have been convicted of a crime or who have been incarcerated, and we have said, you don't have a public platform. We have stigmatized people, and I think that that needs to change. One of the things that I'm a big advocate of is exactly the point you're making, that the criminal justice reform movement, people that are trying to reduce the number of prisons we have, reduce the number of people incarcerated, reduce the amount of racism in the system, that movement has to have voices like yours front and central and in leadership positions, because you do know. And one of the things, and you know things that I will never know, one of the things that I've seen when I've talked to some activists and advocates on this issue is they say, especially 20 years ago, it was impossible to get a voice like yours heard in among the civil rights activists, among the prison reform.
That is absolutely untrue. I've taught people at all levels of education, all races, and many of them were contributors, and so many, some were ex-felons who became stars in the criminal justice system in terms of parole and probation, et cetera. I think this professor needs to get in a police car. His defense attorney job probably restricted his total view. There's more to it than that. I understand his concern. I don't like these people locked up either, but when you have somebody that consistently commits felony after felony after felony after felony after going through these reform movements, these processes, what do we do with them? Tell me.
Movement. Because sometimes, you know, well-intentioned people, but they said, well, if we give them a voice, then we're just going to lose our organization's credibility on the issue. And I think that's wrong, because that position just reinforces the stigma. Lately, that's been changing. I interviewed a former public defender who now runs an organization out of Ohio, a guy named David Singleton, who a lot of people in this room know. He told me that his organization has recently been hiring and promoting and putting out front and center people who have been incarcerated, who have felony and other criminal convictions, precisely because those voices change the minds of legislatures in the way that other voices cannot. So I agree with you. And there's one other thing you said that I totally agree with, which is you talked a lot about poverty, and you talked a lot about class, right? And a big part of my book
is about exactly that. It's about how, even in African-American communities, that we have a class division that we don't talk enough about. Since the 1960s, the chance of going to prison for a black man who has dropped out of high school has gone up 10%. The chance of going to prison for a black man who has graduated from college has not gone up at all. And that difference has a huge impact.
And one of the good things that's happened, I would support this, is that colleges no longer look at a felony record of applicants to the school. That could be a problem, but generally it is not. And again, having taught ex-felon prison inmates, et cetera, we need to help them, and we need to give them direction. And some of them are very intelligent people, and they just need that opportunity. I agree with that. But on the other hand, we just can't turn loose felons who continue to wreak violence on people.
On the decision makers, because they don't necessarily feel the pain of incarceration in the more elite segments of the community that, in fact, have more power to make these laws. So I thank you for what you said, and I thank you for making that powerful statement.
I'm sorry that question took so long from the man in the audience, but he had something to offer, but we couldn't hear it because the sound quality is not that good. So what we're going to do is call it an evening. I think I recommend that book highly. It is called Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And I think it would be good reading and raise lots of questions that you would enjoy trying to find the answers to. Okay, that's it for tonight. We're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off as she usually does, and she'll be singing We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue sky drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know where.